All right. Good evening, everyone. Welcome. This is the Reading Odyssey, and we are discussing Aeschylus's plays. We're going to be discussing The Libation Bearers, part of the Oresteia Trilogy, and it's April 11th, 2017. And we have a good group of folks who've been with us for 3 months now, and we're going to continue reading through the Oresteia, and we'll be reading some Sophocles and Euripides before we're all done. So I'm going to open up the discussion now with a general quote or maybe a prompting question. We've had a little bit of discussion over the email, so I'll bring that up, you know, when appropriate, but I just want to open up the floor to y'all who are on the call with me right now. So if you would, just as usual, just state your name. My name is Andre, and before you make your statement, that way we know who's talking, and then we can kind of hear each other. All right, thanks. Go ahead and let's hear from y'all. What great quotes have you seen or read in the play this last few weeks? We have. I'm going to turn to the beginning of the play, and in classical literature, it's always a great place to start. The first word, the first phrase, always has a purpose behind it. And whether this is the first word of the Greek text, I'm not sure. But they talk about Hermes below, and so we have a reference to Mercury or Hermes here, and the underworld, his role as the messenger god, but also as the herald who leads the souls to the underworld. So that's something for us to think about. All right. Any great quotes? Last time we had a really nice one about an oxen stepping on our tongue. So,
this is Harry Keller. I'd like to offer one up.
All right, Harry, let's hear it.
It's on page 109 of the book. It's line 77, I think, of the play, early on in the play.
Yeah.
And this strikes me as a wonderful encapsulation of what it would be like to live under, a fascist or communist or some kind of a dictatorial rule that's really, really bad, really an evil one. It starts off, it goes, "So yes, and of course, in my mouth are proper for both the just and the unjust acts of those who govern my existence. My mind is their fist. I should fight down bitter revulsion. Still I weep behind my sleeve for my master's empty luck, and my body is frozen hard with secret grief."
Yeah.
That phrase, "my mind is in their fist," is just really something.
Yeah. Good. Let's unpack that a little bit. We're, again, if you're still kind of flipping for that line number, we're looking at lines, I think, 77 to 80 or something, 81. Very interesting quotes from the chorus. This is right before the chorus finishes its opening remarks. And we're talking about just the feeling. What does it feel like to see your city going through this, we could call it a revolution, we could call it a coup d'etat, we could call it political turmoil. But these were things that even the great philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, and so on, said that were one of the worst things that could happen to a society is to have this sort of turmoil. So how does that's good. My mind is in their fist. We have have just and unjust acts of those who govern my existence. We're witnessing here in this play how the leadership has, made mistakes and made some good decisions, but how the people, as representing the chorus, are trying to, deal with this. You know, who do they?
Yeah, this is.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. This is Brian.
Yeah.
Everything that leads up to that is about vengeance and sin, and even what I got from it, at any rate, is no redemption. I don't know. I'm reading off another text, but the man who violates a virgin's bed cannot be redeemed. All rivers flow into one stream to cleanse his hand of black blood, which defiles him. Such waters flow in vain. So whoever the murderer is can never be forgiven, and they've created a great tragedy that is going to affect a lot of people, and there's no going back.
Yeah, yeah. What whereabouts is? Do you think that is? What you can give us a line number, perhaps?
Yeah, 70. I'd have to look on my Kindle because I got
That's good. So it should be right close by here. So vengeance. Vengeance is very difficult to wash away, or some things are very difficult to wash away. There's a nice quote on line 68 that has to do with the embodiment of ruin. And I think I read somewhere that the Greek word is ate, A-T-E, long E. And ruin, limitless pain in her hands, puts the offender off until the full power of his sickness bursts against him. So there is this is right following maybe what you were saying, gory vengeance never washed in, never vanished. There's this real struggle to somehow accept and digest and deal with what's happened between the ruling in the ruling family.
This is Nan.
Yes.
And I was a little confused reading this play because they talk about vengeance and how Orestes has to come back and kill Clytemnestra and Aegisthus to avenge his father, and how it's the right thing to do, and the chorus actually tells him basically he has to do it, which is strange for a chorus to do. He actually tells the character what to do. But yet, at the same time, there's all this, the Furies will come after Orestes, and he will be damned. And so on the one hand, they're saying vengeance is, to avenge his father's death is the right thing to do. The Oracle said he had to do it. But at the same time, he's going to be damned if he does. And it just seemed to me this back and forth between should he do it or should he not, And he kind of, as if again, fate, he had to do it, but he was going to be damned.
Yeah,
and then the Frank Renzler, I felt the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, he knew what he was going to do. He's going to be punished for the act, but he had to do it anyway. So, like
right.
The rest, he's always trying to wrestling what to do and what not to do, but he was compelled to do it.
And is he compelled by Apollo? Is that right? Or who is it that compels him to do
this? Yeah, I think it's Apollo.
Yeah, it's Apollo.
Okay. So let's go back a few lines to line 61, and it says, "But justice with her scale loses sight of no one." And what is just? Did he do a just act? And if so, why is he being punished? Right? So vengeance and justice, there are these questions. How do they relate? Great. So other themes, other observations about the opening.
It's vengeance, and this is Stephen speaking. It's
yes,
vengeance,
Stephen.
And it's justice, and it's duty.
And
it's
duty.
It's the duty that damns him, because had he killed only Aegisthus, there would have been no guilt. He wouldn't have encountered the Furies, but it is by killing his mother that he incurs the guilt.
Uh-huh.
But then again, why should she be exempt from retribution when she's the one that supposedly planned the whole thing?
She's not exempt from retribution from anyone other than her children. It's not that I'm saying this is the right thing. I'm just saying in the Greek thought, matricide and triumph of parents in this sort of overt way brings down the Furies, because it represents the breaking of the primal bond of all of society. So in killing your mother, you are actually starting a revolution, in a sense.
And just as she had killed her husband, and so there's a now as far as the people, yeah, that's good. As far as the people are concerned, they have to decide who they're going to be loyal to, right? What is their duty? And if we look at line 83, my body is frozen hard with secret grief, and those are the last words before Electra speaks. And I interpreted that as the people are afraid to mourn for Agamemnon or Clytemnestra publicly. They're not sure, maybe, or they're not sure if they're going to incur some punishment or I don't know. But there's this inability for these Greeks to mourn openly, right?
Oh, I think, again, Stephen, I think they're absolutely certain that they will be punished.
I agree with that.
Has shown this time and again. Oh. My mind is in their fist.
Yes.
I fight down bitter revulsion. And my body is frozen hard with secret grief. I cannot mourn because the iron hand that grips the mind will rip me apart if I do so.
Well, that's really interesting. So is it a, you know, this sort of restraint, is it a psychological restraint? Is it a social custom restraint? Is it a physical, you know, restraint? I mean, what are they talking, or all of those?
I think, this is Frank, I think it's physical. Because as you go through the play, Chorus gets more and more bold in encouraging Orestes and Electra to take vengeance. Once they see they have champions that are willing to stand up, all of a sudden they become much more supportive of getting vengeance on Clytemnestra and Orestes.
Yes. Yes.
That's how I saw the canon go through.
That's a good point. The Chorus does seem to take sides. So that's good.
This is Nick. I guess I felt a little bit sympathetic towards Clytemnestra, because Agamemnon is not exactly a loving husband or a lovable guy. I mean, he killed their child, Iphigenia, and, you know, sacrificed her. And then, you know, in the Iliad, I think, he's not exactly a nice guy. I mean, Achilles hates him. And then he takes on, you know, and then he comes home with a mistress, basically. So I don't know. I kind of had some sympathies for Clytemnestra, and I wasn't really sure. I mean, I guess this is jumping ahead a little bit, but you know, I wasn't really sure then her feelings about Orestes. I mean, it sounded like at one point. Well, I guess I'm probably jumping ahead too far, but she says, you know, when she finds out that he's dead, she cries out in devastation, you know, this is at 690, you know, I cry our devastation in its fullness, you curse our family rise against you, you know, you watch, you know, and so on. She's really devastated that Orestes is gone, is how it sounds to me.
Yeah.
Nurse, a little bit further, says, well, she's faking it, you know, in line 740, you know, she's weeping through scowling eyes and hid a smirk over events that turned out very well for her. So I was very confused about her and her motivation, and I was sympathetic to her, but then I never really understood, did she love her children or not, you know?
This is a good question. Let's take a look at that. Maybe I found something on line 737 or so, and it says it's Kilissa who's saying, for the servant's benefit, she's talking about Clytemnestra, and she says, for the servant's benefit, she, I think it's Clytemnestra, wept through scowling eyes and hid a smirk over events that turned out very well for her, though for the house they're catastrophic. So another right instance of somebody doubting whether Clytemnestra is really... right. What are our feelings about it?
This is Elizabeth. What is the meaning of her having sent Orestes away?
Yes.
I mean, when was that done? Was he young? Was he apprenticed? Or did she just want to get him out of the way? Why wasn't he in the Trojan War with his father? You know, all of that.
Yes. Let's see
too
here.
Young at the time.
He was too young. He was too young for the Trojan War, Elizabeth, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was sent away by his mother, who I think was somehow hoping that, she would deal with having killed his father. Although he sent away before that, right? Wait,
in the intro on page 101.
Yeah, it says Clytemnestra wanted her son out of the way as she prepared her husband's murder.
Yeah.
Right, so she sent him away before she murdered him, right.
Yeah.
Right, but then she put him out of her ability to control him.
Right.
So there's been, let's be clear, there have been at least 10 years time since Agamemnon left and fought in the Trojan War. So Iphigenia was killed or sacrificed by Agamemnon probably in the first year of his departure. So he's coming back, right? And so he's on his way, and so she's got a lot of time to think this through, right? And so it's some time in between, in those 10 years, maybe 11 years, whatever, she sent him, Orestes, to Strophius. And Strophius is a guardian to Orestes. He is an ally of Argos. And this is in the town, the city-state of Phocis, I guess. So, and now, thankfully, Orestes has gained a friend. Probably, he's grown up with Pylades, Pylades, who is Strophius' son, and I think Pylades is sort of his friend who accompanies him in this, right? So he's got a little support. But in a sense, he's bringing an outsider into his hometown, his home city-state. And this is another issue that the Greeks are probably more sensitive to, that he's coming back, that is, Orestes is coming back with the intent to overthrow, and they're bringing in a foreign ally, in a sense. You know, it may not seem as insidious, but others could spin it that way if they wanted to. So
I don't know, Andre. This is Frank. I think the minute that Agamemnon killed the Iphigenia, Clytemnestra said, "I'm going to kill this guy."
Yeah.
And she probably had a little something going on for her cousin from the beginning. And when she off to Troy, she said, "Let me get rid of the kid. Orestes is going to be my only rival here, primogenitor. He'll be viewed as a king. Let me get him out of here. Send him to an ally." And take over. I think that's what was going on in her mind.
Now, what would be
Frank?
A good? Yeah.
Hey, Andre, let me. Frank, are you sympathetic to Clytemnestra?
Not particularly, but I can see where she's coming from.
You understand?
I killed my daughter to change some winds.
Yeah.
Not a good enough reason to kill my daughter. I'm going to get him.
I know that one of the earlier speakers was sympathetic to Clytemnestra. Does anybody else feel sympathetic to her?
Yeah, this is Elizabeth. I when I was a teenager and I read these books, I wasn't. But now as as an old lady, I am. I'm very sympathetic to Clytemnestra. I mean, obviously she's criminal, but they're all criminals, really.
Can you say more about it?
This is Nan. The thing that gets me is, do we know for sure who instigated this, in the sense of how do we know that Aegisthus didn't convince Clytemnestra that she should kill Agamemnon? And that, because he wanted to take over the throne and he could, you know, maybe she was just controlled by him.
Well, he also had
I mean, he may have
this Nick again
as well.
This is Nick. I think you're right. He also had an axe to grind because his father had been fed the children, his own children, by Agamemnon's father.
Right.
So he also, I think, had there was some definitely some family issues there.
I'm reading it from the perspective of and throughout the play too. There are some lines where again women are evil and women are bad and women cause all the problems, and it's a theme through a lot of these Greek histories and Greek plays. And maybe it's not the woman, maybe it is the man.
This is Scott on that point. I thought it was very striking. This is something that comes up again and again. I mean, first of all, there's this idea that there's something sort of monstrous that Clytemnestra and Aegisthus are sort of ruling jointly rather than just the man being the ruler. And then at line 140, Electra sort of kicks the theme off by saying, "And listen, father, give me a life more decent than my mother's by far, and her hands that are kept to their sacred duty." And then there's something later about, you know, women should shrink back. And then, of course, as Nan already referred to, I think it's around line 600, where there's just this catalog of monstrous women.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very insistent theme. But you do, you know, and I think for a modern reader, you have to feel a little sorry for Clytemnestra because, I mean, she did lose her daughter and she's up against so much. And I'm sorry I've talked too long, but the only other, when she's pleading for her life at the end, she never mentions Iphigenia. I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Me either, actually.
Well, she's also deferential, you know. She says, you know, if you've come on a matter of state, then it should be of all the men. And she withdraws.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, this is it again. I mean, in the play, it seems to be, you know, in this cycle, it seems to be an assumption that, you know, women aren't entitled to rule, to be happy. I mean, your husband could go away for 10 years, kill your daughter, and then disappear for 10 years to the Trojan War, and you should just be, you know, sort of like Penelope and just, you know, fending off the suitors that whole time. But Clytemnestra was not that way. So, I mean, I am very sympathetic with her. I'm certainly sympathetic that she would hate Agamemnon and not want to go back under his thumb.
Yeah,
what her alternatives to killing him were, you know.
I was more sympathetic to Clytemnestra in the previous play because that's really the essence of the previous play. I think someone raised the issue, Nan, I think it was you, about why doesn't she mention Iphigenia when she's pleading for her life? And the answer there is that the focus of this play, it seems to me, is on Orestes and his bifurcated conscience, as it were. We've got, let's call him the proto-Hamlet.
This is very like Hamlet, yes.
Trying to decide what the right thing is to do in this case.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't really want to kill his mother, but he's been ordered to do so. So if he doesn't kill his mother, he's going to have all of these plagues and pestilential things happen to him. And if he does kill his mother, he's got the Furies to deal with.
Right.
Yeah, let me jump in. This is Andre. This is really good. I've been thinking this through, too, and when Clytemnestra decided to kill the king, her husband, she had to have somebody to replace him. Otherwise, it was open season for anybody to take over the kingship. So she holds the place with Aegisthus. Maybe she wanted her son Orestes alive until he could be old enough to take over the throne, right? But when he shows up in this play, he's not going along with this plan. I mean, maybe he's going to take over the, but he's not going to let her get away with it. You know, he's not buying into that part of it. And what I like in the second scene or second act, I mean, which is where Electra kind of he and Electra meet. This is on page. This is on line 212. Okay.
Yeah.
Electra has been already talking with the chorus and sort of helping kind of prepare the people of the city-state to receive Orestes, because she keeps pleading for him to come, and she hopes he'll come, and he does come, right? So she's kind of helping in her own way. She can't take over because she's a woman. She will not be able to assume the throne, because it's a very the patriarchal society. But as far as she can, she's doing what she can to help anyone else, especially Orestes, come in and kind of take over, I think. I mean, what do you guys think of that? I've just kind of trying to, you know, think it through on the political level. Because she has a role to play. I mean, we're going to read plays named, you know, titled Electra later. So what kind of role is she playing in this play? And then what role will she, how will her role change in Sophocles or in Euripides, you know? Within the boundaries of Greek society, that is, where a woman really cannot, you know, be the supreme leader, but still has a role, at least in these plays.
She wanted Orestes to take over. There wasn't any indication that she had plans in the play to bring him back, and she certainly wasn't treating her daughter Electra as someone that was part of the royal lineage on an ongoing
basis. Right.
But it doesn't seem that's the direction that she was going with.
Then why didn't Clytemnestra, like, just exile Orestes or kill him or something and get rid of him? I mean, she couldn't do it, right? And so she's that shows she has some feeling for her son, right? And she wants him alive, but why? And what was her plan? How would he fit into her plan? Yeah.
I mean, is there any reason to believe that he wasn't he beyond the beach?
Well, yeah, this is Nan.
Go ahead, again, go ahead.
Sorry, guys. Let's just take a breath.
Go ahead, Nan.
No, in the beginning, in the introduction, it says that she did exile him, but then it was a mistake on her part because he was beyond her power. And she couldn't control him like she was controlling Electra. And how she was ultimately expected to deal with the problem of her son is unclear.
Okay.
Well, this is Alan. If you follow the logic pattern here that's set up, what is Clytemnestra and Agassiz? What is the transition of power? Because Clytemnestra and Agassiz have no children.
Right.
So when they pass, what is the political transition to the next state?
They could go through Jesse's family.
Yeah, it could be. It could go back over somehow to Aegisthus's a line. But again, right? There is no heir apparent, let's say, right? There is no any designated heir at this moment. So there is sort of a political vacuum, so to speak. I mean, she and Aegisthus are in charge, but it's they still haven't won the confidence of the people in that role. So interesting.
This is Alan. I'd like to come back and spend a second talking about what justice means, because early on, in about line 310, justice, as from the goddess standpoint, is labeled essentially an eye for an eye. A bloody stroke, let a bloody stroke be the penalty.
Absolutely.
Yet near the end, Apollo has charged Orestes and said, kill your mother, but I will protect you in many ways. And I think the chorus is saying, okay, with the death of Clytemnestra and Aegisthus, then things will be okay. So, but we've had this cycle of blood begets blood, killing begets killing. And I guess the question for me that he's trying to address here is, how do you break that cycle?
Yeah.
And where does justice come in if it's not an eye for an eye?
That's good. So Apollo's directive to Orestes to do this, right? It's that's clear. But what is the? How does this all work out, right? And how is justice going to be served in the end for Orestes? He addresses this in line 246, where he's speaking and he calls out to Zeus. Come witness what's been done to us. Look at the father eagle's young, referring to himself and Electra, bereaved after he died, caught in the wreathing writhing of a hideous viper. I'm assuming that's Clytemnestra. Desolate, they're crushed by famine, famished, still unfledged. They can't carry prey homeward as their father did. And then he says, you have me here and her as well, Electra. Before your eyes, a brood robbed of its father, both of us banished, equally as homeless. And then he goes on and talks about how is this going to end? Is it going to end in the extinguishing of the of this royal line or not? And so he's just not sure, you know?
Yeah, this is Brian. This is Brian, I'm sorry. Maybe there's a possibility that there is no justice. That it doesn't end, that it just keeps going on and on because they all have a duty to avenge the last generation or avenge, you know, the last person. And that's the tragedy of the whole thing, is that it just keeps going on and there isn't any perfect justice.
That's a good point.
Other than the...
But this, Alan, on line 1030, Orestes says, the chief authority who graced and nerved me is Pythos' prophet, Luxius, Apollo, who declared that I could do this blamelessly. But if I shirked it, you know. So he's been told that he can do this,
yes,
and he'll be held blameless.
Yes.
And this is Nan. Who would be around to avenge Clytemnestra and Aegisthus' death? Electus for it.
Nobody.
Yeah, that's a good question, right?
So it and could it, end there.
It could.
Well, the Furies.
Right?
The Furies would have.
The Furies.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So,
because as someone else pointed out earlier, because he killed his mother. If he had just killed the justice, it would have been okay.
Right, but then when Orestes is gone, it's done. When the Furies get Orestes, it's done.
Yeah.
Well, does that mean that Aegisthus has no one to avenge him?
Yeah, that hasn't been really that hasn't been clear, has it? I want to point out on line 276, Orestes says about Apollo. Apollo said, "My own dear life would make this good." And so, yeah, is it going to want? Is that what Orestes has to do to seek justice? Is to sacrifice himself, right? Whether he's actually sacrifices life or just, you know, has to suffer the punishment of the Furies. Knows he's going to be cursed. I mean, he admits it in lines 285 to 295, something like that. And yet, the chorus says at the bottom of page 115, this is lines 308, 309, powerful fates bring this to the end that Zeus has sanctioned. And then come the way justice's steps turn. They're calling out for justice. That's all they want.
You know, it's funny. When I was in high school, the trilogy was called The Fall of the House of Atreus. So I think the one point that somebody made earlier, it's a whole tragedy. The whole thing collapses because it's just too much tragedy, too much murder, too much hate, too much, you know, internecine battling that it just can't sustain itself.
Yeah.
And the Furies only come in and wipe it out in the third book.
And that passage you just pointed out, though, it's an interesting interesting passage because the chorus undermines itself with the last line.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, powerful fates bring this to an end, the end that Zeus has sanctioned. Come the way justice's steps turn. So he goes through all this and says, for a bloody stroke, let a bloody stroke be the penalty. Let the wrongdoer suffer wrong. So goes the saying again and again. It has grown old among us.
Yeah.
So this is the way it always has been. That doesn't mean it's the way it should be. And the saying, you know, this cycle has been perpetuated forever. So even though we're calling for it now, we know that it's ancient and not necessarily good.
Uh-huh. So
what line was that?
This is lines 312 to 314.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's really good. So Stephen, are you saying that this play is trying to explore a new solution, a new way, a way of getting out from under this eye for an eye kind of mentality, maybe?
Well, I think it's directly pointed at that because in the passage that you were quoting before, Orestes makes it very clear. It's around 270, 280. He says, otherwise I would fellow with repulsive suffering. So you had quoted the line, he said my own dear life would make this good. Otherwise I would fellow with repulsive suffering and the forfeit of my goods. Then the explicit tally of afflictions appeasing hateful powers beneath the earth. The fierce boils that assail. In other words, he would just deal with it if he hadn't been promised this. And he is, you know, here is one I have real sympathy for because he's trapped between a rock and a hard place. One god says, go and do this and I'll protect you. And we all know how trustworthy the gods are. And he knows for a fact that if he does this, the Furies are coming after him and he can only rely on the promise of help, which ultimately he gets. But the question of justice is a hard question, and it's a question that involves conflicting loyalties even here. And the eye for an eye isn't working.
Now, somebody's going to have to take the fall if there's going to be justice in this system, right? You just said, otherwise I would bellow with repulsive suffering. The word bellow is used a lot in the ancient literature when an animal is being sacrificed, like a cow or a bull. And I have to go check, you know, a commentary on this, but that's what it alludes to me. And it just seems more and more that Orestes realizes that he's gonna have to sacrifice himself in this larger tragedy. You know, he's sort of just stuck in it. And the chorus, like you said, in lines 313, 314, this is just the way it's going to have to happen. That's all they can see. So does Electra provide any sort of an option or another way, another possibility? I mean, what are they talking about here? In lines throughout 300s, you know, from 300 to 400, there's a lot of talk here. Electra says in lines in line 398, I demand justice from the destroyers of justice. Listen, Earth and the powers below that we honor. So, So, I think she's obviously, you know, wants to support Orestes, but somehow or another, she may be expecting something a little bit different to happen. I'm not sure.
I think if you go back a little further to 330, you hear a different song from Electra where she says, "So listen, Father, this is our rightful share of tear-soaked mourning. Over your grave, the loud song of your loss rises from your brace of children. We are suppliants and refugees alike. At your tomb, it must take us in. What trace of good is here outside it? What is only free from evil? Is ruin not left wholly undefeated?"
Yeah, what is she saying, that they are better off with their father that is buried and dead, or free from evil? Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting. I think she says basically there is no good here. There is no good way to end it. There's no good way to go on. The only good is being dead, because everything else is just utter disaster. Is ruin not left wholly undefeated?
Well,
yes. I'm sorry. This is Brian. Correct me if I'm wrong. He was very influenced by Herodotus, wasn't he?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think it's pretty.
Because Herodotus always talks about the happiest man, and the happiest man, they always, you know, the luckiest man, is always the one who has already died and they can't experience tragedy anymore, and everything kind of worked out all right for them up to their death. And, you know, if you go on living, then that's when bad things happen to you.
Yeah, he could have been. I mean, and whether he, you know, read Herodotus or heard Herodotus, I mean, that they were pretty contemporary, I guess, right? I mean, they were pretty close in time. So the thinking, the thought, the ideas are definitely concurrent. So yeah, I agree. I agree with you there. There's something about that. So the attitude toward death here is very important. I'm just wondering if that changes, because we're still kind of in the first half of the play here, and there's a lot of dialogue that carries through, and I'm just wondering if there's any kind of progress made with this. There's a lot of talk about justice, you know. Let's see.
Well, Andre, this is Alan. I don't think there is, because this, if you go all the way to the end, in the last line says, "Where at last will this fierce havoc find something to lull it to sleep to end it?"
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just sitting now, putting myself sitting in the stadium or the theater. This is the second play. He's raised the question now, and I guess we got to wait till the third play to find out how he resolves this.
Right. Yeah. That's really good. I want to get to that. I want to look at line 500. Where Electra and Orestes, they may be still kind of commiserating, but they're also kind of throwing out ideas about what to do. And Electra decides in line 500 to address her father, who is dead. Says, "Now, father, hear this final straggling cry. See how your nestlings huddled by your tomb, the male, the female, keening, pity both." And then they are appealing to Agamemnon to come, kind of maybe his spirit, to somehow be involved or intervene. And then it's soon after that, at line 530, we hear that Clytemnestra is being plagued by a nightmare. I don't know if those two things, you know, are connected, but there's something supernatural going on here, because they're not able to do anything more on the physical level here. They're both feeling like, you know, they're not fully capable of completing this task, so now they're calling upon a spirit. And there's something going on with Clytemnestra as well. Maybe it's her guilt feelings, or maybe it is some sort of spiritual intervention, but there's something going on here. We're getting near the middle of the play, and I'm beginning to sense that there's a, what do you call, a crisis point or a turning point, maybe, that finally they have some way of implementing some kind of a plan. And that might be taking place on in lines 555 on, where Orestes starts to, you know, make some, you know, start making some statements, coming up with some sort of plans here. So let's take a look at that.
Guess one thing that you were just talking about, that line there about how Clytemnestra, it seems like she's having misgivings because she left some kind of an offering there. He's pondering that. What does it mean? I guess in the end he kind of dismisses it, and I was a little surprised by that. You know, she's clearly bothered by what she's done because she's having this nightmare and premonitions, I guess. And Orestes is just, he's very firm in his resolve. He's not like Hamlet in a way. I mean, Hamlet agonized a lot more than Orestes seems to be in this section.
Yeah.
I don't know what you guys think of that.
Consider the length of the play. I would say to start with, but secondly, I would say that the discussion between Orestes and Electra is, and there are other reminiscences of Macbeth here as well, but they have screwed their courage to the sticking point. So finally they say, all right, this is the way it is. There's nothing good. There's no other recourse. Whatever I do, I'm damned anyway, so let's move ahead. So the determination is, let's go. Here's the plan.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's good.
Oh, I mean,
good.
The same point, just going back to 555, the rest is basically saying, you know, our Lord Apollo promised, and he was never a lying prophet. So he's putting his hands in Apollo's view of what he should do.
Yeah, that's good. That's line 559, yeah. And so, if anything, Orestes is being encouraged, right? And maybe he just needed to kind of establish that, and the chorus is definitely encouraging him as well as Electra. And now he is taking that initiative, right? And he's coming out with some real action. What do we call those, action points or something?
Hey, Andre, I just want to jump in.
Yeah.
I didn't hear a couple of voices. I was wondering if Mark Casey, are you still with us? Did you? I don't think have we heard from you yet tonight. Do you want to, you know, either respond to what we're saying now or share another thought you have about this? Are you there? That's a danger of a cold call like that. someone might be on mute, or they may have stepped off. All right. Well, continue then, Andre. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. So look at the chorus and how the chorus sort of responds to Orestes' plan. This is on line 585 or so, and talks about the earth fosters many afflictions. The arms of the sea are teeming, and then high in the air. These are all staggered references to the elements. And so, you know, some really interesting stuff going on here, and how the chorus then says in lines, 593, a man's reckless pride, who can describe it, or women's scheming arrogance. You know, making a statement about, you know, Agamemnon and Clytemnestra, perhaps, I don't know. And sort of they're trying to wrap themselves around the fact that something actually is going to take place finally. What are the outcomes? What are the possibilities here? So yeah, maybe they will finally see something happen, but then what will then happen?
This is Nick. I guess I was a little bit bothered by Orestes' plan. You know, he doesn't feel like a hero here. He's kind of coming up with this lie, you know, this disguise, and he's not, I was expecting him to kind of have a confrontation and say, hey, you know, you killed my father, and so prepare to die, like in The Princess Bride kind of thing, you know? you killed my father, prepare to die. And it felt a little bit more like Odysseus, you know, in those stories, he's always the liar. He gets out of trouble by coming up with some lie or scheme or whatever. And I don't know, I guess I was just, I haven't read enough Greek plays to know if this is kind of typical or is this unusual at all, or I don't know what you guys thought about his plan there.
Well, I mean, this is Scott. I just thought that this was another example of, you know, of how hard it is to have justice in a situation because they've taken over. They have all the power. They can only be overthrown by a full-throated foreign invasion or by treachery. There's no court to take them to. So he's doing what he can.
Yeah, and it's
funny that there's actually like suspense. It's like, is this going to work? Because, you know, which you don't really associate with Greek tragedy. You know, will Augustus come without his guards? Will he separate them?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought your point though was more that he didn't give a nice speech. He didn't do it in the noble way.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, you know, it's Orestes and his pal that have shown up from, you know, exile. All the forces are arrayed against them behind Orestes and Clytemnestra. What choice does he have? If he wants vengeance, he has to do it surreptitiously.
Yeah, I suppose.
Now think about what
does feel less heroic.
Yeah, well, it is, and it's here's two things here. If we're looking at these are lines 555, you know, to 580. He says his plan is like Odysseus, right? He's going to he's going to pretend to be a foreigner, and he is sort of right because he's been living in a different country. So he's going to sneak his way in. He's going to try and trick his way into Aegisthus's presence, and then kill him. Now what I just realized is that on line 566, granted no cheerful welcome from the keepers of the gates into this house possessed by wrong. We'll wait. Someone passing by the palace will judge from our appearance there and speak. A suppliant's at the gates, and why does anyone lock him out? And anyway, if he is accepted, if he's received into this palace, he's received as a guest. And under those rules, under Zeus's rules as a guest, the last thing he should do is kill somebody, kill his host.
Yeah.
Okay, so you know, that may have been more obvious to the Athenians, but to us, it escaped my attention for many years until just now, and so he's going to be committing another crime, you know.
Yeah.
Even though he's, you know, he's been told by Apollo to kill this guy, he's going to, yeah, this is getting really sticky, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, this plan has got its issues as well. And the chorus doesn't know what to make of it themselves. Now, they have to keep quiet about it and not spill the beans, right? So they're talking a lot about it in lines 5, you know, 85 to 6, where is it? All the way to 651. Now, take a look at lines 645. This is the top of 126. This is one of my favorite quotes. And it says justice is an anvil planted steady, and fate the swordsmith pounds out the bronze. to be ready long before. A son follows into the house to settle its debt at last for the defiling blood let over and over from ancient times, the deep-rooting fury we know so well has brought him. So I don't think that quite answers everything, but it certainly restates that something's going to happen. And justice is the steady part. It's the anvil, while fate is the, maybe it's the punisher. I don't know. But I thought that was pretty, like, profound.
Hey, Andre, this is Alan. The lines where the chorus speaks, they bring up three examples of crimes that women have committed. Is beyond the obvious bias, are they, is the playwright trying to say here that things are out of kilter because of Clemestra and what she has done? She's acted like a man, and that's not proper, so things are need to be restored to their proper order.
Yeah, and I know I've read that somewhere, but I don't know if that's the only interpretation here, you know? I mean, I wonder if anyone would care to read this a little differently, you know? I mean, it could be read that way. Definitely. But on the other hand, you know, we did sympathize with her. At least some of us have sympathized with her, especially in the first play. So how dastardly is she, right? How evil is she, really? You know, that's what I wonder. Yeah.
Well, she does plot to kill her son.
You know, yeah, she does. She tries to.
I think so, because she tells Aegisthus, or the idea is Aegisthus should come with his bodyguards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's not surprised. I mean, she knows, she apparently knows it's Orestes.
Uh-huh. So she's definitely going to, right, she's going to cover her bets here. She's going to make sure, going to at least, right, she's not going to send Aegisthus to be, you know, to be killed. She's got her suspicions, right? She's got her suspicions here.
Yeah. Do you really think?
Yes.
What makes you think she knows it's Orestes?
Well, because when she comes out, she, you know, there's, I mean, one thing that interests me about, and I mean, I'm more interested in Clytemnestra than the playwright is, I think, but is that there's no, you don't really get a sense of her interior life. You know, you know about the chorus and all of their conflicts, their fears, their hopes, their wishes, and you certainly know about Electra and Orestes because they're telling you about themselves. But there is not a place where Clytemnestra is telling you about herself. And you have to, you know, infer it from what the little bit that she does say and what she does do, which is kind of partly related by other people, by the chorus. So we know, and by the nursemaid said, well, she told me to tell, you know, Aegisthus to come with his guards. And then when Clytemnestra, you know, confronts Orestes, you know, after Aegisthus has been killed, she doesn't say, but I thought you were someone else. And I mean, there's just nothing, you know, she knows immediately who he is.
That's good. Let's go right to some of her, you know, some of her words. Let's look at 668, where she first speaks. She's appearing at the gate. She says, calls out, strangers, if there is anything you need, tell me. We have what such a household should. Hot baths. Now, come on, really? A bath? Come on. But anyway, she does, you know, here she's pretty generic. She's like a nice host. She says, you're a stranger, come on in. But then go to 691 on the facing page. I think you're right. I think here she sort of, you know, she kind of responds like, come on, really? You're not a stranger. I cry our devastation in its fullness. You curse our family rise against your hold. And she goes on and talks. Orestes now so steady in his shrewdness, who kept his feet out of destruction's mire. You know, she's talking to Orestes, right? And she's mentioning Orestes. And she mentions in line 698, hope of healing afflictions that run riot in the house. I just couldn't help thinking there that she might just be hinting that if Orestes could only come back and kind of fix this whole situation, you know? I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but that's...
No, I agree with you. I thought that's why she, you know, she regretted her son's death and that she did hope that he would come back.
Okay.
That's how I read that passage.
Okay, good.
And then to the earlier point, someone was saying that they thought that she knew, but then, you know, I don't know, because in 890 or so, after this, he's been killed, she says, you know, then pity me, I understand the riddle. So it's like that's the point when she realizes what happened. We'll die the way we killed, by trickery. So yeah. I don't know if she knew it was him.
Well, this is Nan. A few lines later, she says, hold back, my child, my son. This breath demands it. Often you dozed here. So obviously at some very soon after the I understand the riddle, she does know it's Orestes, and Orestes doesn't say, hey, I'm your son.
But so this is
somehow
this
that is, got known to her.
Yeah, this is the in the Greek, they'd be playing with us, just like in the Oedipus story, you know. What they're saying two things at the same time, and they're saying stuff they don't even realize. You know, she is talking about him almost like she knows who he is, but it does she, and it's hard to tell, right? The end of the Odyssey, when Odysseus and Penelope are in the bedroom together, and they're still wary, like, are you really, you know, Odysseus, are you really, you know, and so they test each other, right? So this is part of what they call the recognition scene in the ancient literature, where the two, you know, maybe here the protagonist and the antagonist, or the two main characters, they meet, and they, you know, they're almost, you know, when are they going to actually recognize each other? When are they actually going to, and this is where the play starts to really ramp up. I kind of look at this as Act 3, starting at this, in this area here, and this is where things really start to, you know, keep the audience on the edge of their seats, you know. When are they going to actually realize who each other really is, and that kind of stuff. Eventually, we've already talked a little bit about Aegisthus meeting this stranger, Orestes, without the bodyguard. And it is the chorus is part of this conspiracy to help make Aegisthus vulnerable, right? So we see later on line 838 or so, when Aegisthus enters. Let's see.
Hey, guys.
Yes.
Is there somebody snoring?
I think so.
Might be. Well, you know.
Somebody sleep.
It's not the first time.
Oh, my gosh. So.
Ophanies.
Maybe we woke them up.
Right.
Yeah. So we, you know, the whole Aegisthus episode where he enters and he's killed almost like right away, you know, right after that. And it's heard off stage. I'm looking at line 870. The chorus is calling out what's happening and what does it mean for the house. So then we get into the final confrontation. And this is where the recognition scene is finally fulfilled. Orestes and Clytemnestra are face to face. And we're looking at what Clytemnestra really thinks. So would you look at line 894, 895 with me? Clytemnestra says, the champion I love, Aegisthus, dead. And Orestes asks, you love the man? So this is where, you know, the moment of truth, literally, right? What does she really think? maybe she's been trying to keep in a lot of what she's thinking and feeling from the public. But here's where it comes out.
I also think it's significant that Orestes asks this question and makes this threat through this, because what he reveals here is that, because he then goes on to waffle. You know, he says to Pylades a few lines down, "What should I do, shrink back or kill my mother?"
Yeah.
There's still some doubt in his mind about what he should do, but
yeah,
she almost clenches it by saying that she loved Aegisthus, who Orestes can kill with impunity, who could see as the main orchestrator of his father's death. Even if Clytemnestra was involved, if she is the one who woven the net that trapped Agamemnon, it was Aegisthus who struck the death blow, as it were.
Yes.
Almost exonerating her mom for her complicity until she says, "I love him."
Yeah. Yeah, I found that to be a pretty, important moment. And then she appeals to him as a mother, and he's questioning that. Now, remember the prophecy, how she dreamed that she gave birth mm-hmm. to a viper, and mm-hmm. now she was compared to a viper at some point. And here they are trying to, you know, kind of, they're sort of circling each other, so to speak, you know, in rhetorically, I mean. And she's trying to gain his trust. He's trying to fight against her, you know, trying to do that. I don't know. This is really interesting.
This is
give
the most
take.
Gripping scene of the play for me. I don't know about others, but this exchange between Clytemnestra and Orestes,
yeah,
mother and son,
yeah,
it's quite.
But as someone mentioned earlier, it was disappointing that she doesn't bring up that he killed the daughter, and when she brings up that he played around,
right,
Orestes blames her for that. It's her fault he played around.
Yeah,
I mean, let's read that. Why don't you read that starting at like 9:10 or so?
"So fate shares the blame, my child, for what has happened. Then fate has made your bed now, which is death. Child, you don't fear a parent cursing you? No, you're my mother, but you threw me out to an ally's home that isn't throwing out. You sold a free man's son, which is a crime. You say so. Where's the price I got for you? I'm too ashamed to taunt you with the words. Your father played around. Don't leave that out. You sat at home. Don't blame him in his hardship. A wife kept from her husband grieves, my child. A husband's hard work feeds the sheltered women."
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, what was the? I mean, it's interesting. He says a husband's hard work. I mean, what was really Agamemnon doing? It was hard work to support her. I mean, he was going off to Troy to avenge the, well, whether kidnapping or not, so debatable, you know, of Helen.
Yeah. Right.
He was fighting a war. But I think it's also, well, he was the king, he was responsible, blah, 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 blah. I mean, part of my reaction to this section, I mean, it's really interesting because there are a couple of lines where, you know, you can literally hear a modern parent and their child arguing, right?
Yeah, it's very modern.
Yeah, you threw me out. You called, wait a minute, to an ally's home, that's not throwing you out.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of go back.
It's definitely very contemporary.
But then it shifts gears, and it goes into this really what we would, as moderns, of course, see as extraordinarily sexist debate about, you know, well, but, you know, she says, you know, hey, I grieved. And there's something so poignant in that, but he can't hear it, Orestes, and he comes back with, well, a husband's hard work, you know, feeds the sheltered women, which isn't even really, it's just a, you know, platitude of that time. And then she says, "My son, I think you're going to kill your mother." And that's just, wow.
And let me point out that in the original Greek, we heard Sarah Rudin say that she translated this line for line. And, you know, Phil, you mentioned that too. But I'm looking at the original Greek, and every single line is, you know, it's one line per character. And each of these lines, of course, is written in a poetic meter. So it's an extremely, extremely crafted kind of like give and take response. I don't think I've seen this many lines alternating like this between two characters in any other plays yet. So this is quite remarkable how it's sustained over at least 20 lines of one character says one well-fitted line that fits exactly that meter in that line, and then the next line, you know, it's a complete line. Back and forth. It's really, really remarkable looking at it in the Greek. So This might be the scene, you know, in this play that really, really, you know, brings it all home.
Yeah.
The thing I found interesting, these two are talking to each other, but they're not. They're talking past each other.
Right.
Either one hears what the other is saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's yeah, and then we have, you know, we have the chorus bringing up justice again. And finally, you know, it all goes so fast at this point. I find myself just saying, "Whoa," you know, all of a sudden the play almost comes to an abrupt halt in a way. Where Orestes is left, he's now alone, and he's committed the act, but where's Electra, you know? He's all alone. The chorus is there, I know, but they are, I don't know how sympathetic they can be. I don't know how compassionate or helpful they can be here. They're telling him he did right on line 1042, but... you know, saying it and taking away his feelings is two different things at this point. So the way this ends is, for me, was very, you know, I was definitely left wanting more. So, you know, thankfully we have another play to read for next time. So we'll definitely talk more about it. But are there any closing, you know, comments on this play, especially these last...
Yeah, Andre, I have a question from a performance standpoint. This is almost like the old movie serials, but did the audience take a break between plays? In other words, this leaves you just hanging.
Yeah.
Do they have an hour break? Do they have more wine? I mean, I wonder what goes on.
It was an all-day affair. Sometimes it went on for two or three days, depending on the festival. But they probably had a break in between each play. I don't know, but I can't tell you that for sure. I mean, I would just kind of assume. And remember, there were three. There was usually a trilogy of tragedies, yep. And then there would be a fourth play, which was a tension breaker, or a satyr play, which would then kind of like, you know, relieve everybody and make them laugh a little. So if they were there all day, they'd probably like break in between the play. That's just my opinion. I don't know for sure.
And I think it's an important point. The notes to these plays, overall notes, this is the only real trilogy we have extant, that these three plays actually were performed as one on one day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think we're reading. I thought I saw on the list Oedipus, Rex, and Antigone later on. And the three of those form a sort of trilogy, but they were not performed on the same day. So this is one where, indeed, it could be a sort of between the acts thing. You're going to see the end of this by the time you leave today.
Right. Yep. Yeah, this is really that. That's why I'm glad we're reading the Oresteia. It is a whole, you know. It's a triptych.
This is Elizabeth once more. I mean, Electra also disappears.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, you know, I think that Clytemnestra is treated in a very external way, unlike the other characters. Electra isn't treated that way, but then she just simply is written out of the play.
Yeah. Yeah, that's dissatisfying to me, too. I mean, and she's not really part of the third play, the Eumenides, although she is. Well, we will read more about her, right? But later, but not in Aeschylus.
Yeah, and it's very odd that she's not there at the end, at least.
Now, you know what else was interesting is that Aeschylus did write about her in Seven Against Thebes, and but she's not right. He writes her out of this, which is strange. You know, she is such a. I think she's an important character in this play we read today.
Apparently, most of modern literature thinks she's one of the most important characters because you've got Eugene O'Neill with Morning Becomes Electra, Richard Strauss's play Electra. You've got Mozart who did Idomeneo, King of Crete, who tells you about the end of Electra. So Electra and Medea are two of the biggies in sort of modern literature.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
A lot of people seem to think that she was kind of important.
Yeah, I saw Strauss's Electra this, I think it was last spring.
Yeah.
It was sometime within the last year. Very, very powerful.
Yes. A
great.
Short opera, hour and 45 minutes, highly recommended.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. That was very good. Thank you for saying that, Stephen. Yeah, yeah, and also thanks for last time we mentioned. Now, who was it that mentioned the gospel at Colonus? That was really interesting. Yeah, who was that? I'm sorry, I forgot.
Our author, our translator.
Yeah, that's right. Sarah Rudin did. That's right. So, you know, even though we're not reading that particular play, it's really awesome to see that kind of a performance. It was really interesting. All right. Anything else that anybody wants to close with here?
Good session.
I'm already looking forward to reading the last play here with you all. It's called The Eumenides. You know, I'll just say that there's an ancient story about a Greek who brought his pants to the tailor, and the tailor asked the customer, Euripides, and the customer said, Eumenides. So, anyway.
Very nice. Very good.
Bada bing bam.
Yeah.
It's an oldie, but it's a goodie.
Yeah.
So
it is.
That's boring back again.
It's pretty tragic, but you know what can I say? All right.
I'm
well,
glad you said it.
Get it out there.
Had to get it off my chest. All right, folks, that was very good. So, yeah, and thanks. You know. Thanks to Alan for you know sending out that email. It really got me looking at the appendix and made me really interested in looking more carefully at the context of these plays. You know, we don't know enough, but I'd like to talk about that more too. So, you know, what were the Athenians thinking? And yeah,
when was the email sent out?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. I think I sent out an email last week. And it just sort of addressed what I found in Appendix A. It's a short article. It's really good. If you have time, look at some of those articles in the back. They're really helpful in explaining some of the bit of the context of the Athenian city-state and the place of the tragedy in it, which is really, really good. Appendix A. If you hadn't gotten it, I'll resend it out just so you can see some of my thoughts on it.
Thank you.
All right.
Good.
You sent it on Thursday morning.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. I think I did. So I'm reading
you
Appendix B now.
Yeah, I think you could send it again.
Yeah. Okay. I'll send it out again.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you all.
Thank
you, Andre.
Okay.
Bye. Good night.
All right. Good night.